Luke 9:37-43, the 42nd talk in a series entitled The Gospel of Luke, was presented by Jack Crabtree on June 11, 2006 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, I want to return to the Gospel of Luke. I think what I'll be doing over the next few weeks in summer is resuming our study in Luke, and I'll be in and out as I take some trips this summer, but when I'm here, I think we'll just plow away through Luke. We're going to be in chapter 9, starting with verse 37, but it's been so long since we've been in the book, let me just give you a brief review of the context here for this event. The passage called the Transfiguration has just happened. In the Transfiguration, the disciples had made their way up to the base of Mount Hermon, and Jesus takes Peter, James, and John with him up onto the mountain. And there's evidence here in the text that it was at least an overnight trip. So they went up to the mountain and camped out up on the mountain. While they were there, this remarkable event happened where Elijah and Moses appear to Jesus. And they, as I would understand the text, they seem to be encouraging him with respect to his upcoming crucifixion, his upcoming death on the cross. And apparently what they're doing is encouraging him from the perspective that this is the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. This is necessary. You are bringing about what the text calls an exodus, which I think is their liberation, their freedom from sin and death for mankind. And by reminding him of the significance and the import of what he's going to do, are trying to encourage him in the face of this incredible event that's about to happen to him. And as I pointed out when we looked at that passage, we really see the humanity of Jesus in that event. The fact that he would need encouragement, that he would need to be fortified and strengthened by other people, in order to carry through in obedience to this fate that God had in store for him. It's all too often, I mean, after thousands of years of history, Kierkegaard makes this point in Practice in Christianity, that after thousands of years, we're so accustomed to thinking of Jesus as this victorious, triumphant, divine being that we completely lose sight of his humanity. And the real, true stumbling block of Christianity is coming to understand Jesus in his humanity, and as we look at him in his humanity, to still be able to say, Jesus is the Son of God, Jesus is the Messiah. That's what we're seeing in the Transfiguration, is a man who's very, very human, I think. Well, this event that we're going to look at today is happening as Jesus, Peter, James, and John are descending the mountain. They come down the mountain and they meet a group of people, a crowd of people, and that's where our text takes off. So 9:37. On the next day, when they came down from the mountain, a large crowd met him, and a man from the crowd shouted, saying, Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only boy. And a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly screams, and it throws him into a convulsion with foaming at the mouth. And only with difficulty does it leave him, mauling him as it leaves. I begged your disciples to cast it out, and they could not. And Jesus answered and said, You unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you and put up with you? Bring your son here. While he was still approaching, the demon slammed him to the ground and threw him into a convulsion. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the boy and gave him back to his father. And they were all amazed at the greatness of God. But while everyone was marveling at all that he was doing, he said to his disciples, Let these words sink into your ears, for the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. But they did not understand this statement, and it was concealed from them so that they would not perceive it, and they were afraid to ask him about this statement. An argument started among them as to which of them might be the greatest. But Jesus, knowing what they were thinking in their heart, took a child and stood him by his side, and said to them, "Whoever receives this child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For the one who is least among all of you, this is the one who is great." John answered and said, "Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to prevent him because he does not follow along with us." But Jesus said to him, "Do not hinder him, for he who is not against you is for you." Maybe at this point, let me read the same accounts from Matthew and Mark. I don't often and normally do this, but Mark includes significantly more detail, and as does Matthew, and we get some different information from the other accounts that I think is going to help us understand what's going on here. I'm reading from Matthew 17, verse 14 right now. "When they came to the crowd, a man came up to Jesus, falling on his knees before him and saying, 'Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is a lunatic and is very ill, for he often falls into the fire and often into the water. I brought him to your disciples, and they could not cure him.' And Jesus answered and said, 'You unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him here to me.' And Jesus rebuked him, and the demon came out of him, and the boy was cured at once. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, 'Why could we not drive it out?' And he said to them, 'Because of the littleness of your faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible to you.' And while they were gathering together in Galilee, Jesus said to them, 'The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day.' And they were deeply grieved." And then I'm skipping to chapter 18. "At that time the disciples came to Jesus and said, 'Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?' And he called a child to himself and set him before them, and said, 'Truly I say to you, unless you are converted and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for him to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea." And then finally, Mark chapter 9. Starting with verse 14. "When they came back to the disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and some scribes arguing with them. Immediately, when the entire crowd saw him, they were amazed and began running up to greet him. And he asked them, 'What are you discussing with them?' And one of the crowd answered him, 'Teacher, I brought you my son, possessed with a spirit which makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it slams him to the ground, and he foams at the mouth and grinds his teeth and stiffens out. I told your disciples to cast it out, and they could not do it.' And he answered them and said, 'O unbelieving generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him to me.' They brought the boy to him. When he saw him, immediately the spirit threw him into a convulsion, and falling to the ground, he began rolling around and foaming at the mouth. And he asked his father, 'How long has this been happening to him?' And he said, 'From childhood. It has often thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us.' And Jesus said to him, 'If you can, all things are possible to him who believes.' Immediately the boy's father cried out and said, 'I do believe. Help my unbelief.' When Jesus saw that a crowd was rapidly gathering, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, 'You deaf and mute spirit, I command you, come out of him and do not enter him again.' After crying out and throwing him into terrible convulsions, it came out, and the boy became so much like a corpse that most of them said, 'He is dead.' But Jesus took him by the hand and raised him, and he got up. When he came into the house, his disciples began questioning him privately, 'Why could we not drive it out?' And he said to them, 'This kind cannot come out by anything but prayer.' For there they went out and began to go through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know about it. For he was teaching his disciples and telling them, 'The Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he has been killed, he will rise 3 days later.' But they did not understand this statement, and they were afraid to ask him. They came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, He began to question them, "What were you discussing on the way?" But they kept silent, for on the way they had discussed with one another which of them was the greatest. Sitting down, he called the 12 and said to them, "If anyone wants to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all." Taking a child, he set him before them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me, and whoever receives me does not receive me, but him who sent me." John said to him, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to prevent him because he was not following us." But Jesus said, "Do not hinder him, for there is no one who will perform a miracle in my name and be able soon afterward to speak evil of me. For he who is not against us is for us. For whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because of your name as followers of Christ, truly I say to you, he will not lose his reward." Okay, what do we have here? A man who has an only child, a son, an only child, is evidencing signs of epilepsy. He's had this epilepsy from infancy. The cause of the epilepsy is alleged to be a demon, an unclean spirit. It's constantly has, throughout his life, constantly endangered the life of the boy. And the man is, having heard evidently the reputation of Jesus and, in fact, the disciples, has decided that he wants to give that a try. And so he brings the boy first to the disciples. I don't know if he's looking for Jesus and Jesus is on the mountain and can't find him, but he brings him first to the disciples. They can't cast the unclean spirit out, and somewhere in the chaos of that, an argument breaks out that involves some scribes, according to, I think it was Mark. So there's this hubbub going on just as Jesus and his other three disciples arrive coming down the mountain. Jesus asks them, "What's up?" They explain to him. The man begs Jesus to cast the unclean spirit out, to heal the boy. And Jesus inquires of the man a little bit, asks him some questions. How long has this been going on? What's the problem? The man answers. Jesus sees a crowd growing, gathering around them, and agrees to command the unclean spirit. And does. The unclean spirit throws the boy into convulsions, but then eventually departs. The boy is left weakened and perhaps asleep, and people think that he's dead. And Jesus picks him up, takes him by the hand, and raises him up. Then we have, that's that particular account. There are other accounts that, if we have time, we'll look at. The one thing I want to point out right up front about those is when you notice that in the Matthew and the Mark account, they're not in immediate succession. They're days apart. So if we were just reading the Luke account, it would seem like it's just sort of this event after this event after this event, and that they are contiguous in time. But they're not. One of them occurs while he's in Capernaum, and another one occurs before that while they're just traveling around Galilee. So it's after this, they occur after this event, but not in immediate succession to it. Okay, but let's focus first on the son with epilepsy here. Oops, find my notes. Okay. The first thing I ask about this passage is what exactly is going on here? Why this event? We have passages that describe, and many people, and he was healing many people and casting out demons from many people. So, Why is he focusing on this specific event of casting out a demon when both Jesus and the disciples have cast out by this time numerous demons? Remember, by the way, the disciples couldn't cast out this demon, but they had been. Jesus had sent them on a mission before, where among the other things that they did is cast out demons from people as they proclaimed the coming of the kingdom of God. So it wasn't something that they hadn't done before. Right up front, I'm going to call it casting out a demon, but I don't like that language, but I can't help myself. It's just too familiar, too much a part of our idiom. What Jesus is doing in casting out a demon is ordering it to depart, ordering it to leave, I think. And the problem with the language of casting out demons is that it makes it sound like you have a demon, like you have a sliver in your finger or something like that, that it's this foreign body, this foreign object that happens to be an intelligent being that is inhabiting you, and that you're having to kick it out and no longer allow it to live in the person. I don't think that's true. You don't have a demon in the way that you have a sliver in your finger. You have a demon in the same way that you have a pet parakeet. It just intersects with your life at various and sundry times, and it plagues you, and it oppresses you, and it bugs you, and it irritates you, and it causes all kinds of pain, sorrow, or inconvenience in your life. But I don't think we have to take this language to see it as an ontological or metaphysical inhabitation of a human being by another alien kind of being. If that's true, I don't know any good reason to think that that's true. But I'm still going to use the language cast out a demon, but understand that I'm not convinced of the Hollywood view of what a demon is and how it operates. I think the reason this event is significant for a couple of reasons. One, the disciples couldn't cast it out. And you'll notice in Mark, and especially in Mark, how much detail he includes about this event. This episode must have been etched painfully into their memory. I think what we're seeing here is a colossal failure on the part of the disciples. And I'll explain the nature of that failure in a second. But I think the shame, the embarrassment, the awkwardness of this for them made this a very memorable event. And they remember a lot of details about what happened here. So partly it's included because it's etched into the memory of this group of disciples, the ones from whom all this information about Jesus is coming. Second thing that's significant about this event is probably not the only one in the gospel, but it's one of the most remarkable ones in the gospel. We have here the healing, Jesus performing a healing, and he's not accrediting the faith of the person that for whom he's doing the miracle. We don't really see any evidence of any faith on the part of the father of this boy. I mean, look at the text, what the text says. In Luke, a man from the crowd shouted, saying, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only boy." This sounds to me like a father who desperately wants help. I mean, there's all kinds of people who go to faith healers today, or fortune tellers, or psychic healers, or any number of, we'll explore any number of avenues, not because they believe them, but because they've tried everything else, and that didn't work, and it's kind of, why not? What's it going to hurt? I'll give this a try. Everything in this text suggests that that's more the attitude of this man than that he believes that Jesus is the Messiah. And based on his confidence that Jesus is the Messiah, he's confident that if he will, he can heal this boy, and therefore he's bringing him to Jesus and asking him to will it, to ask him for the mercy to do so. In the Mark account, that becomes more explicit. The way the man phrases the question is, if you are able, you can cast the demon out. And Jesus says, "What do you mean if I'm able? What do you mean if? With God, all things are possible," one of the texts says, which is also very significant and very interesting, because Jesus deflects it. It's not about me being able. I'm not the one that will do it. It's God. It's my Father who will make the demon depart. And if my father wants it to happen, it's going to happen. It's not a question of able. I am just as able as my father is, because I'm not doing it from who I am. It's the father who's doing it, and I am simply acting in obedience and in service of the father. He's the one who has to be able, and of course he's able. But but the father is not approaching Jesus in the way that many of the people that in the miracle accounts, you see them approaching him. where they call him the Son of Man and they somehow affirm his authority and affirm that they believe that he has the authority of the Messiah, and then the miracle happens. This man doesn't have faith. Now, I know there's a whole stream, a whole tradition in Christianity that talks about faith healing, as if the power and the magic of healing happens because of the faith of the recipient of the miracle. That's rampant in Christian culture today. But it seems to me we have a passage here that flies right in the face of that. Because what Jesus is making really clear to this man is, this is all about God. This is not about human beings. It's not about the ability of human beings. It's not about the power of human beings. It's not about the gifts of human beings. It's not even about the faith of human beings. When God works miracles, it's because God is working a miracle and God is able. God is never not able, no matter what the issue is. So I think that's the second reason that this particular account is significant, is because we have an unusual situation where Jesus is responding to someone simply and purely out of compassion and mercy, not out of a way of credentialing the legitimacy of their faith. It, like all miracles, of course, it's intended to stimulate and provoke faith, to give people the evidence to know that he indeed is the Messiah, as all miracles are. It's a sign in that way. But it's not why he's doing it. He's doing it because he's determining that his Father is willing to have mercy upon this man who doesn't even know what he thinks yet, who doesn't even really believe yet. Okay, why were the disciples unable to free him? We don't have any clue really here in Luke, except that he responds by, you unbelieving and perverse generation. Perverse is a very unfortunate translation. What he's trying to say with that Greek word, I think, is that Greek word refers to being misled, kind of convoluted in your thinking, wound up, screwed up in your perspective, all tied up in knots because of the confusion about what's true. That's what the word implies. This is a lost, confused, ignorant, a generation with their understanding of reality all mixed up and all messed up. That's what he means. You're an unbelieving and screwed up generation, is what he's saying. Who's that directed at? Is it directed at the man? Yeah, it is. I mean, this man is not coming with faith. He doesn't understand who Jesus is. He doesn't understand the significance of the reports of Jesus' miracles at this point. But I think he's also directing it at the disciples. Something has gone wrong. And the fact that it is reported to him, I brought my son to your disciples and they could not cast it out, has got Jesus' attention. And he responds, oh, this unbelieving and messed up generation. How long am I going to have to be here? How long am I going to live in this environment? We get another clue in Matthew and Mark that we don't have in Luke. And it seems to happen later. One of those accounts says in private, they went to Jesus in private and said, why couldn't we cast it out? And we don't have a long account of his answer, but he just says, the way they translate it is, this kind can only be cast out by prayer. Well, wow. that conjures up all kinds of, I think, what are false images in our head about what he means and what he's saying there. Let me tell you what I actually think he's saying. This kind is not this kind of demon. We don't have a taxonomy of demons in the New Testament, nor no indication that there are blue demons and red demons and green demons and, well, there must be blue demons, but we don't have some kind of taxonomy so that we know who's capable of what and what kind of magic you need to perform on which demons in order to get rid of them. This is not Harry Potter. This is reality. And so I don't think that's what he means by this. It literally in the Greek is this, this sort of. I think he means this sort of being, this sort of reality, this sort of thing. It's not this sort of demon. It's this sort of phenomenon requires prayer in order for you to get it to depart. Why prayer? Because I think what Jesus has recognized is there's one and only way that the disciples could have failed. The only way the disciples could have, because God doesn't fail. I mean, it's not like the demon was too challenging to God and the power of God. That doesn't make any sense. So what was it that transpired such that the disciples would command the demon and it wouldn't come out, and it didn't come out? Presumably, it's because the disciples had gotten cocky and perverse in their thinking, messed up, screwed up in their thinking. Namely, they had somehow lost sight of the fact that Jesus is making clear in these accounts, they had lost sight of the fact that you don't order demons out. God orders demons out. You don't have the power, the gift, the ability to magic, the magic inherent within you to go around ordering unclean spirits to do things. Unclean spirits are far more powerful and far more significant and have far more authority than you do. So in these past several months or weeks or whatever, as you've been going around ordering demons to depart, it hasn't been because you've had the ability to do something that they have been departing. It's because God has been acting. It's because God has been intervening and moving in his power and banishing these demons. And the disciples evidently had lost sight of that and were caught off guard when this man just sort of comes out of nowhere and says, there's this unclean spirit that's causing this condition, and would you have mercy on us? Would you get rid of this demon for us? And evidently, the disciples copped the attitude, yeah, well, I've got 15 under my belt. Peter has 20 under his belt. I think we can handle this one. Yeah, well, let's see. What do I say? I mean, I don't know how it went down. But whatever the attitude was, it apparently was one of self-adequacy and self-importance. And so out of that self-adequacy and self-importance, they say the right things, they take the right measures, whatever that is, and they are completely humiliated in the process. God does not act. God does not honor their words. God does not intervene to banish the demon from this boy's life. And this had to be an incredibly humiliating experience for them. I mean, I'm sure you know from your own life how vividly you remember those days and the details of those events that were so grievously humiliating to you. And I think that's why we have the kind of detail in these accounts, is some of these disciples were pretty, pretty humiliated. And Jesus is just reminding them then, when they come, why could we not cast it out? He simply says, basically, well, you got to ask God for this kind of stuff. You can't do it. It's not you that have the power. Next thing I want to talk about a little bit is the epilepsy here that this boy has. Seems to me that we have three options for how we are to understand this account. One option would be to understand that this boy simply has epilepsy in the same way that anyone among us might have epilepsy today. And that Jesus and Luke and the crowd and the whole ancient world is just so superstitious and so ignorant and so scientifically and medically out of it that they know of no other way to explain the phenomenon than an unclean spirit. They're wrong about that. It's not really an unclean spirit, but, you know, they're ignorant people from centuries ago. They didn't know better, so they thought that this was an unclean spirit, but they were wrong. That, of course, if that's the case, it seems to me seriously calls into question the things that I've been talking about the last couple weeks about biblical authority. I don't think we can ascribe authority to the Bible if, in fact, the people who are giving us the worldview are revealing their worldview and understanding of reality to us, namely Jesus and the apostles, are so terribly wrong about something like epilepsy. So if they're wrong about that, then we need to seriously rethink what the Bible is and what's the nature of its authority. Now, we could just sort of dogmatically dismiss it, but I don't think that would have integrity. You know, I don't think we can say, I believe the Bible, and the Bible gets everything wrong, right, and if they say it's an unclean spirit, then it's an unclean spirit. That's not the way we should approach that question, because we believe in the biblical authority based on the evidence that we have, if I'm right in my argument from the last couple of weeks. We've gleaned our evidence from the gospel accounts itself, assuming a certain kind of historical reliability, and based on that evidence have decided it really makes sense that Jesus believed the scriptures had authority and that he is the Messiah, and that if he has authority, if he who has authority over me believes the scriptures have authority, then who am I to tell him he's wrong? But here's also part of the evidence that we need to look at in coming to the conclusion that the Bible has authority. So we shouldn't be obscurantist and dogmatic and just kind of close-minded about this kind of issue. We should take seriously the challenge that this presents. This could be a huge, colossal mistake on the part of Jesus and the apostles, and if it is, that has significant implications for whether or not we grant authority to the scripture. However, in saying that, to take the position that this, you know, they just chalked up everything to demons, so we shouldn't take it seriously, they were just making a mistake. That assumes a priori, I would argue, that demons never are and never have been in the picture. And that's just a prejudice. My contention is, here's the problem we face, and I've said this before, the problem we face is that you and I can't speak for you, I can speak for myself, I've never been within 50 miles of a demon in my entire life. I don't know what it's like to come to the conclusion that someone is being demonized, is being affected by a demon in their life. I don't have enough experience, I don't have any evidence to be able to know the difference between something where the genesis of that is organic, biological, physiological, and when it is supernatural in the sense of being demonically induced. It's very possible, if the biblical picture, as I understand it, is correct, it's very possible that these ancient people who had a lot more experience with that knew the difference between epilepsy that was physiologically, organically induced, and epilepsy that was demonically induced. I was looking up on the internet a little bit about epilepsy. It's pretty amazing how much they don't know about epilepsy. They know what's going on, they know what's transpiring, but in terms of the causes and the origin of epilepsy, sometimes they can locate the part of the brain where it has its origin. Sometimes they can locate some of the physiological realities that are the genesis of the epilepsy. But oftentimes, and for the most part, in most cases of epilepsy, they don't have a clue why it's happening and where it's coming from. The point, I'm not making the point, it must be demons doing it. That's not my point, because I don't think that's the case. I think it is organic. I think it's physiological. I have no reason to believe that demons are causing epilepsy today in the people that are epileptics today. My point, however, is that whatever the physiological mechanism is, whatever triggers it could be a malformation in the neural structure, in the brain structure, in some physiological structure of the body, and therefore have a genesis and a physiological defect. That's possible, but it's also possible that it could be being affected supernaturally by a spirit. So Is it epilepsy? Sure, it's epilepsy. What's causing the epilepsy? In one case, it could be organic and physiological. In some other case, it could be demonic. And they just know the right buttons to push in the brain or in the neural system to cause this sort of an effect. That seems entirely possible to me. We know, for example, that some things that can be due to physiological defect can be induced by drugs. We experiment with that, and we do that. We give people a drug, and that drug interferes with or enhances or changes or transforms a physiological mechanism, and there are certain results. Well, that's from the outside, in a sense, if you will. It's not, the genesis is not organic. It's actually chemical, an alien chemical introduced into the system that has a certain kind of an effect. Well, could it be that unclean spirits are capable of accomplishing what chemicals can accomplish as well? In some cases, it wouldn't even surprise me if unclean spirits are capable of, in some strange kind of way, communicating with people and have them eat strange things that have strange chemicals in them that induce certain kinds of effects in people. What I have in mind is, I remember back to the event of Rodney King. Rodney, what was it? Was he on angel dust? Angel dust. Rodney King, in that famous episode, was being chased by police. He was high on angel dust, and he basically exhibited supernatural strength. Now, what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, those of you who know, but one of the effects of angel dust is to suppress a mechanism in the body that our body has a mechanism in it. We're much stronger than we're capable of being strong. We're much capable than we're stronger than we're capable of manifesting. And the reason is because we have a built-in mechanism in our body that suppresses the use of our strength. Because if we were to use our strength to the level of our strength, we would break our own bones. That is, the leverage of the thing we were trying to lift, for example, would be such that it would actually bust our skeleton, bust our bones, because our own strength is breaking us. And so we have built into us a mechanism that tells us, nope, don't be that strong, don't lift that much, don't exercise that much strength, in order to keep us within the limits of our own skeletal structure and muscular structure. Angel dust suppresses that. So people who are on angel dust exhibit what would appear to us to be supernatural strength, because it's not giving them strength that they didn't already have. Of course they have that strength, but we've never exercised or manifested that strength before, because our normal physiology normally doesn't allow us to do that. But there's this chemical that can be ingested that suppresses that, that unleashes the actual strength that's always been there. Well, could a demon do something like that? Could an unclean spirit interject something into the system, or push some button, or press on some neuron such that it suppresses that mechanism in the system and they have supernatural strength? We appear to have that kind of phenomenon in the account that we looked at however many months ago, the man in Gadara, who Jesus cast the demons into the herd of swine. He appeared to have supernatural strength. They couldn't keep him in chains. He kept busting his chains. Well, how did he do that? It may seem kind of odd to us to think that an unclean spirit, an invisible, immaterial being, could actually add strength to a human being. I mean, what's that all about? Well, angel dust can do that. I mean, there's a mechanism in angel dust that can do that. Could an unclean spirit duplicate the same kind of physiological phenomenon? I don't see any reason why not. But the remarkable thing about the New Testament, unlike other ancient literature, is how reserved it is in the judgment about unclean spirits and demons. It doesn't hesitate to call something an unclean spirit or a demon when it's convinced that it is. On the other hand, it doesn't attribute everything to unclean spirits and demons. There are people who are blind who have been blind since birth. There are people who are lame who have been lame since birth. There are people who are deaf who have been deaf since birth. And nothing in the New Testament account says, and the demon made it so. They don't even pretend like that's the basis for it. In fact, in the case of the man born from birth, and the disciples say, why is it so? The assumption, the question is that God has cursed them because of their sins. And Jesus challenges that. It's not because of his sins or his parents' sins that he's born blind. It's so that the glory of God might be made known. But he's clearly attributing it to God, not to a demon, not to an unclean spirit. So what you find in the evidence of the New Testament is a kind of discernment. Some things are organic. Some things have their genesis in just the nature of the physiology of the person, or sickness or illness, or something has gone wrong in the world. And other things, they don't hesitate to say, it's a demon, it's an unclean spirit. Now, from our perspective, from my vantage point, that just seems really odd. Because I just see a lot of sick people with a lot of physiological problems and a lot of physiological issues, and never once have I been tempted to attribute it to a demon. But I think the reason for that is because demons aren't operating in the world the way they were back then. Satan has been locked in the abyss, and the power of evil has been curtailed by the light having come into the world and shined into the darkness. And I think the fact of the matter is we just aren't seeing that kind of phenomenon happening in the way that it was occurring in the time of Jesus and the apostles. And because it's not happening, you and I have no empirical experience with demons. And so we don't even have a clue how you would know, what it would mean to know that it's an unclean spirit. It may be that there are additional symptoms, additional attributes, additional phenomena that accompany the epilepsy that leads them to know that it's an unclean spirit. We're just not giving any information from the text. But that's what would make the most sense to me. I'm running out of time. Anyway, it doesn't seem to, the first option doesn't seem to make the most sense in the light of everything that we know in the New Testament. I don't think Jesus and the apostles are just ignorant, simple-minded, superstitious people, because nothing else in the New Testament would suggest that they are. This is not superstition. This is their own discernment about what the particular genesis of this epilepsy is. Okay, I'm going to... That in the text, probably the thing that is most significant about the judgment that this is an unclean spirit is the fact that the text records, as Jesus was yet approaching the boy, the demon threw him into convulsions and he had a seizure. Well, that's true. There are certain kinds of epilepsy that have certain trigger mechanisms, but there isn't it odd that it's the approach of the Messiah that is the trigger mechanism of this form of epilepsy? I mean, that's what appears to be the case. That seems to be what the gospel writers are saying, is the connection between the seizure and Jesus is that it's upon the approach of Jesus that the young boy has the seizure. Well, the thing that makes the most sense out of that is that this is an enemy of God, an enemy of Jesus, who is the origin and genesis of this seizure. Well, I think I'm going to, we've run out of time. So why don't I leave it there? We'll finish this next week, finish this account, but just so that you have some time for your questions or comments, let me leave it there.
I'm kind of working with all the stuff that you're talking about, and I'm thinking about, I don't know how this is going to come out, in other words, because I'm kind of thinking on my feet here, but okay. I'm just wondering about, we live in a time and place where we really want to figure out what causes things, and a lot of what you've said can take me in the direction of the importance of figuring out the cause of something. I don't think that's what you're necessarily saying. But I wondered if you might talk a little bit about the difference between figuring out what causes something versus working with what should our response to be to something. So in other words, whether it comes from a chemical thing, a neurological thing, a spiritual thing, I think we could go in the direction of my struggles are my fault in some way. That ultimately, it seems to me that God is bringing our struggles into our lives through whatever means that he's using to do that. And our response to that reality is where our faith is being worked out. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Can
you?
Well, mm-hmm. I want you to say more about that in a second, but the reason for my preoccupation with what the cause of this is that the gospel writers seem to know the cause of it. And that becomes problematic to us, or to me at least, in the 20th century, because I would never think to attribute that cause to that phenomenon. I would never think to blame an unclean spirit for epilepsy. And so that raises the question, do these guys even know what they're talking about? So that's my only concern here. That's my reason for raising the question. I think you're talking about something entirely different, which is how do I deal with problems that I'm dealing with in my life? Is it crucial, is it critical that I get to the cause of them before I can confront them and deal with them? Is that?
Yeah, and I think the reason for my concern is that I think that we are steeped in that in some way. And we're always looking for a reason for what's going on, maybe so that we can fix it, which in some ways is really helpful. I mean, that's a good thing to do. But I guess I just wanted to put that out there and work with it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because it also seems like in light of just having to work with that, it's mm-hmm. sort of the process that we're in. And you're right. I mean, I get what you're saying. I appreciate that clarification because it's not really what you're doing in terms of trying to understand the authors here.
Right.
But I'm thinking we could kind of spin it out that way because that's what we're living with all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Well, you would agree, wouldn't you, that if we could know the origin of something, that perspective that would give could be helpful to me in a variety of ways.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. If somehow I'm thwarted in being able to understand the origin or genesis of something, that doesn't stop me from dealing with the problem itself. That there are.
I think that's a great way to say it, because it's because sometimes we are thwarted, and that's a good way to say it. Because if we could know, that'd be great.
Yeah.
But we sometimes don't.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the bringing in the blind guy, blind from birth, because. That's another thing I think we just kind of take in is like, well, God must be punishing me for something, or, you know, it's like, well, maybe, maybe not. Maybe mm-hmm. something else is going on, and I don't know that we can know that
right.
on
right.
that level or need to work that hard to figure that out.
Right.
Is
no,
that,
that's a,
would
yeah.
you agree with that?
That's a
yeah.
good point.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I missed the first part of your talk, so I may be asking a question you already answered, but you have any conjecture as to even the situation where you have this young man who's demon-possessed, or however you want to say it, what that's all about? I mean, the word young man sounds strange to be thinking of a young person who is possessed by a demon in some
way. Well,
it's
worse than that. I think the word that he uses in response to Jesus when he says, when did this start? I think you could translate it infancy, that it started in his infancy.
You have any conjecture on all that, what that's all about?
You mean what are demons doing messing with infants?
Yeah, and how, yeah, anything related to that. I mean, typically, I think in my modern mind, and because of where the church is at and certain sects of the church, it's an invitation. You invite a demon in. So if it's an infancy thing, obviously that can't be. So do you have some kind of perspective on that?
I have a little bit of perspective on that, but I don't have an answer to that.
That's why I'm asking you to conjecture something.
Yeah, well, my perspective is that we just need to cleanse our modern minds, that we have been trained to think that inviting it, that you would have a demon for the same reason that you have Jesus in your heart. It's because you went forward and invited them into your heart somehow. But that's just, we don't know that. I mean, there's no way in the world from the biblical perspective that we would necessarily have take that point of view. It appears from the gospel accounts, I'm more inclined to think that they see the activity of demons as more random, like viruses are, and like bacteria and various plagues and diseases are. They just, some people are afflicted by them. That now, maybe there's a volitional element to it somewhere, and they would know, but they never make that explicit, at least. If you know of a passage, let me know, but I'm not aware of any biblical passage that would in any way even hint that the reason somebody has the demon that they have is because they invited it in. But we've just made up all these stories about demons because we have no experience with them. So we don't know. We don't know how they work and how it happens that a demon comes into your life and begins to bug you and so on. But I think they would. So they'd have some kind of experience and some kind of track record that would give them some information about that. But we're clueless.
I was curious about the father of the son. I appreciate all the evidence you seem to have here for him not believing. But I've always just gone along with, I mean, just from the verse in Mark 9:20. Or where the father says, I do believe, help my unbelief.
Yeah, but don't forget the second part of that.
What is the second part?
Help my unbelief.
Right. And so when you say, just kind of straightforwardly, he's not a believer. I've heard it taught and just thought myself that this is kind of the someone in process, like we all are, where I believe, but I have doubts, I have fears, I have things going on, and that's more the way I've taken it before. But so what more?
I don't know that that's necessarily inconsistent with what I'm saying. I mean, to describe him as in process, I think is appropriate. So that part where he says, I believe, is him saying, well, I'm entertaining the possibility that you actually are the Son of Man, and I'm open to you demonstrating that to me. I mean, that he's not closed. He's not hostile to it, but he hasn't figured it out either. I mean, he hasn't come to an actual conviction that, you know, I'll die for this thing because it's a foregone conclusion that you're the Messiah. I think that's what he's coming short of. And that's what I'm trying to emphasize. So it's probably more, it's not so much that I'm taking a different perspective as I'm emphasizing something that is not that maybe is not normally emphasized here, and that is, this is not a faith healing in the sense that he's being rewarded for his sincere, authentic, dynamic, large quantity of belief by him responding to him. This guy's faith is problematic. It's unformed. It's in process. It's inchoate. It's not really all fully there yet.
And so you're saying more that what he would die for at the moment is his son.
His son, exactly.
He believes that
exactly.
His son needs to be healed.
Yeah, what's driving him more than his conviction that Jesus is the Messiah sent by God into the world is, this is his only son, and it's driving him crazy that his son is having to suffer this.
That makes sense.
When you were looking into epilepsy, did you see any other accounts in the New Testament where it's called epilepsy as opposed to demon possession?
No.
Old Testament either?
Well, but what's interesting is notice the Matthew account. If you just had the Matthew account, the first paragraph of the Matthew account, no spirits are mentioned at all. Not until Jesus comes along and performs the miracle and casts out the unclean spirit do you have any clue that an unclean spirit is in view here. He calls him a lunatic and that he suffers greatly and describes the nature of that suffering. And you wouldn't really know that that in order to heal him, Jesus was going to cast out a spirit until he does. So that was interesting. To call him a lunatic, which I think means roughly moonstruck, indicates that this is not an unknown phenomenon. I mean, the symptoms are known to people such that they have a name for this set of symptoms. But what seems to be distinctive in this boy's case is the genesis of this phenomenon that they have a name for. But if what you're asking, did he ever just come and heal an epileptic who we know is an epileptic of his epilepsy without and thinking of it as an organic in origin, I don't think there's anything explicit that I could point to.
When you make the comment that you haven't been within 50 miles of a demon, talk about Satan being locked up, is your perspective that basically there is no demonic activity in the world today, or?
I couldn't go that far, but I would say that I think it has been so greatly curtailed that it's not part of our ordinary experience.
So Peter's observation about the devil prowling about like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour, is that different than other than demonic activity, or?
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's a good question. I'm not saying that Satan is not active in the world, because there seems to be evidence that the apostles think of him as being active in the world. But I think what we have are pictures and images that are intended to show us that whatever the activity of Satan in the world is today, it's not dramatic and obvious and manifest in the same way that it was in the time of darkness before Jesus came. So I'm not sure the metaphysics of that and how to sort all that stuff out. But I think these are just broad strokes that we're getting, is that compared to when Jesus came into the world and demonstrated his power and authority by showing his authority over the forces of evil that were manifest in ordinary life for these people, and he banished them and, you know, removed them from their lives, compared to that, we're not in the same darkness that was their experience. Did John have a?
I guess my question is, as you're making this distinction between the sort of the medical and the organic and the spiritual, the natural and the supernatural, does it have to be one or the other, or can't it be both? And if we can study something and explain, oh, this is what's causing this, does that necessarily mean that there's not a spiritual component? If we can study tectonic plates and say, oh, well, there was an earthquake that brought Jericho down, does that mean it wasn't a miracle? You know, why does it have to be either natural or supernatural?
Well, in the case of earthquakes, no, it can be both very easily. That's not a problem. The problem here is their assessment of what's going on in this young boy's life is that there is a actual being that is doing whatever this being is doing that is causing epileptic seizures, and that the cure will be to get that being to cut it out.
But does that mean that it's not, that it's necessarily not medical, that it's not organic?
I mean, no.
Couldn't it be both?
Yeah, but I think the level at which it would be both in this particular case would be, I think if you were to hook him up and take a, help me, EEG? What? And take an EEG, that you would get the same kind of waves that you would get with any epileptic of a similar kind of seizure, with a similar kind of epilepsy. So I think you'd have all the same medical data that you would have with someone who has epilepsy today. And if that's what you're saying, then yes, they're totally compatible. The problem is, there can be two origins of that phenomenon. One is there's this intelligent being, supernatural, spiritual being that is making this happen, and it needs to cut it out. So if I'm Jesus or the apostles, I can tell it to cut it out, and God will make that unclean spirit cut it out, and there are no longer any seizures. If it's organic, telling an unclean spirit to cut it out isn't going to help the person because they've got some malformation in the brain or the neural system that is actually the genesis of the problem, and that's what would need to be fixed.
But that's not beyond the power of, you know, the act of God or prayer either.
Oh, absolutely. Right.
I guess I just feel like we have this tendency to sort of, if we can explain something, then it's not, then there's no spiritual component. If we can study it and find the origin, then suddenly all spiritual aspects can just be sort of disregarded and you know, take a pill, you know, you're fine.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. I mean, everything is ultimately spiritual. Everything ultimately has significance because it's from the hand of God that anything happens, even if you can explain physically exactly how it happened and what happened, it's still God acting. So yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right about that. But here, hopefully you can see the difference it would make. If they are right about it being an unclean spirit, you're going to address the problem. God is going to address the problem differently than if it's an organic malfunction. In the one case, he'll tell this being to cut it out. In the other case, he'll have to physiologically fix the malformation in the organism. That's the distinction I'm making. I've kept you over. I need to let you go. Thank you.